it's a great pleasure to welcome to our treehouse Gary Hall, theologian, Methodist minister, someone who's been studying Thomas Merton for a number of years, almost as many years, I think, as he's been coming to Greenbelt. He says he thinks he might have been at the second ever Greenbelt or an early Greenbelt. So it's a great pleasure to welcome him back, bringing along with him Phil Summers to come and help, I believe. So Gary and Hall, welcome Gary and Hall. Gary, Hall and Phil. This is being recorded. Gary and Phil, welcome to the treehouse to talk about Thomas Merton today.
Well, thank you, and thank you for being here. I'm not a monk. It was an option some years ago. I ended up in Methodist ministry, which is another story. But we're here because it is a centenary year, and we thought at a place like this, it was important that Thomas Merton got a mention. You may know him. You may have read everything he ever wrote. You'd be quite old if you have. You may have heard the name and wondered what's interesting about him. You may be mystified by him. So what we're going to do today is just present some impressions, because we didn't really know what you were looking for and who we had here, and then we'll leave some time at the end to have a little conversation. I'm very grateful to Phil Summers, good friend, who's offered to do some of the readings. So we'll present a few of Merton's readings. It's important you hear more of him than of me. And that will help you to pay attention. If you want to know where they're from and where you can read more like them, we can do all that later on. When someone asked the great theologian David Tracy about the future of theology in the United States, Tracy replied, "For the next 200 years, we'll be trying to catch up with Merton." This year, many of us have marked 100 years since the birth of Thomas Merton. I'm not long back from Kentucky, and before that, there was a meeting in Germany. They've been happening all over Western Europe, and one in Poland, and all over this country. You may have been to one of those meetings. Writer and monk, poet and prophet, contemplative radical. Readers are fascinated, captivated, intrigued, for any number of reasons, not least of which is that Merton seems to forge a way of being Christian, a way of being Christian which addresses some of our most overwhelming challenges, our threats and our human failures, war, racism, rampant consumerism, environmental destruction, xenophobia, media, technologies, which suck the life out of our life together. And he addresses them with a clear-sighted honesty, with humour and hope, and with a contemplative humility which is deeply rooted in the ancient ways and the ancient sources of faith. He was a man of deep hope and occasional despair, who chose silence and enclosure in order to discover compassion and communication, and a world in his bloodstream, as he put it. He reframed old monasticism for a brave new world, a medieval Christian way for a world which had lost its way, a way of discipleship which was rigorous, ascetic, set apart from a self-destructive and self-obsessed world, which likes to call itself the real world. Well, that's one way of introducing him. There are many other ways, quite different, no less true. This is, as I said, the centenary of Thomas Merton, born in 1915 in wartime France. By the end of 1968, and the midst of a very different kind of war, Merton was dead. On 10th of December 1968, his body was found splayed across the floor of a hostel room in Bangkok, killed by electricity. The body was flown home in a B-52 bomber, like other younger bodies bagged up and sent home from the war in Vietnam. His friend, Ron Seitz, who died just a few years ago, wrote a eulogy to the late Merton. I just wanted to read that for you. You sang your presence in poetry, breathed beauty into our lives. You gathered us all in, put a pulse to our innocence, locked love in our hearts, then left, fled, smiling, still singing, parting the trees and waters with laughter. A joyous time of it you had. And we are deeper, more true for your going. We have been called to task. Yours, the note let loose, ours, the word unsaid. Do we hear? And will we answer? That is our calling. 1,000 years, 1,000 poems will not undo you, Thomas Merton. Earlier that day, the day he died, Merton had been addressing a meeting of monks and nuns on the subject of Marxism and monastic perspectives. It may not be a subject which fires your own particular enthusiasm, but notice what he was doing. Just notice what he was doing. A naturalized American who'd received more than his fair share of hate mail for un-American activities, who traveled after half a lifetime enclosed behind monastic walls, traveled to a city in the region of Vietnam where forces of capitalism believed they were battling forces of communism in those heady days of 1968. And this American monk had chosen to speak there about the similarities between Marxism and Christian monasticism. It says a lot about him. And it's no surprise there were rumors about his death. If to some people he was reinvigorating Christian faith for a complex world, to others he was a seriously troublesome priest. He just didn't know how to shut up despite his vow of silence. To his critics, he'd wandered far from the path of the idealized young convert who fled the world to a more holy life at the summit of a 7-story mountain. But this was a man for whom contemplative prayer and political life had never existed in the separate worlds that some imagine.
How the valley awakes. At 2:15 in the morning, there are no sounds, except in the monastery. The bells ring, the office begins. Outside, nothing, except perhaps a bullfrog saying om. The mysterious and uninterrupted whooping of the whippoorwills begins about 3 these mornings. He is not always near. Sometimes there are 2 whooping together, perhaps a mile away in the woods in the east. The first chirps of the waking day birds mark the pont vierge of the dawn, under a sky as yet without real light. A moment of awe and inexpressible innocence, when the father in perfect silence opens their eyes. They begin to speak to him, not with fluent song, but with an awakening question that is their dawn state. Their condition asks if it is time for them to be. He answers, yes. Then they, one by one, wake up and become birds. They manifest themselves as birds, beginning to sing. Presently they will be fully themselves and will even fly. Meanwhile, the most wonderful moment of the day is that when creation asks permission to be once again, as it did on the first morning that ever was. All wisdom seems to collect and manifest itself at that blind, sweet point. Man's wisdom does not succeed, for we are fallen into self-mastery and cannot ask permission of anyone. We face our mornings as men of undaunted purpose. We know the time and we dictate the terms. We are in a position to dictate terms, we suppose. We have a clock that proves we are right from the very start. We know what time is. We are in touch with the hidden inner laws. We will say in advance what kind of day it has to be. Then, if necessary, we will take steps to make it meet our requirements. For the birds, there is not a time that they tell, but the virgin point between darkness and light, between non-being and being. You can tell yourself by the time, sorry, you can tell yourself the time by their waking, if you are experienced. But that is your folly, not theirs. Worse folly still, if you think they are telling you something you might consider useful, that it is, for example, 4 o'clock. So they wake. First the catbirds and cardinals, and some that I do not know. Later the song sparrows and the wrens. Last of all the doves and crows. The waking of crows is most like the waking of men. Querulous, noisy, raw. Here is an unspeakable secret. Paradise is all around us, and we do not understand. It is wide open. The sword is taken away, but we do not know it. We are off, one to his farm and another to his merchandise. Lights on, clocks ticking, thermostats working, stoves cooking, electric shavers filling radios with static. Wisdom, cries the dawn deacon. But we do not attend.
In 1968... Merton was in Thailand, pursuing wisdom, forging new relationships. A friend of activists and an inspiration to many others. But Merton was no activist in the way we usually understand that term. His profoundly radical and sustained action was to reject the roots of war. To reject the roots of war and suffering by letting go the privileges of a society which tolerated and perpetuated injustice. That's what it meant to walk away from the world. The most radical action he could have taken. He became voluntarily poor. He cut the noise of perpetually distracting input, pushing us this way and that. He was not convinced that the way to counter violence and injustice was by making more noise of protest and demonstration, which, as you can imagine, frustrated some of his activist friends as much as he troubled conservatives. We're going to hear something he wrote in 1966 to a young activist called Jim Forrest, campaigning against war in Vietnam.
Do not depend on the hope of results. When you are doing the sort of work you have taken on, essentially an apostolic work, you may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all, if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. And there too a great deal has to be gone through, as gradually you struggle less and less for an idea and more for specific people. The range tends to narrow down, but it gets much more real. In the end, it is the reality of personal relationships that saves everything. You are fed up with words, and I don't blame you. I am nauseated by them sometimes. I am also, to tell the truth, nauseated by ideals and with causes. This sounds like heresy, but I think you'll understand what I mean. It is so easy to get engrossed with ideas and slogans and myths that in the end one is left holding the bag, empty, with no trace of meaning left in it. And then the temptation is to yell louder than ever in order to make the meaning be there again by magic. The big results are not in your hands or mine, but they suddenly happen, and we can share in them. But there is no point in building our lives on this personal satisfaction, which may be denied us, and which, after all, is not that important. The great thing, after all, is to live, not to pour out your life in the service of a myth. And we turn the best things into myths. If you can get free from the domination of causes and just serve Christ's truth, you will be able to do more and will be less crushed by the inevitable disappointments. The real hope, then, is not in something that we think we can do, but in God, who is making something good out of it in some way we cannot see. If we can do His will, we will be helping in this process. But we will not necessarily know all about it beforehand.
It was Vietnam, Cuban Missile Crisis, some of you may remember. Second Vatican Council, you may or may not have noticed. Civil rights action. Martin Luther King's retreat with Merton had been arranged for later in April 1964, and events in Memphis meant it never happened. Merton's planned itinerary for that final 1968 journey was cut short. The journey had taken him from his Kentucky home via India and Sri Lanka, where he wrote, he discovered what he'd been long looking for, a moment of epiphany triggered by the serene smile of an enormous statue of the Buddha at the shrine at Polonnaruwa. Something he had been looking for. It's the kind of thing he said from time to time. There had been other epiphany moments for Merton, other moments of breakthrough, moments of clarity, moments of revelation, when the world catches light. And we're going to hear about one of those towards the end. 3 years earlier, backtracking from that final journey, 3 years earlier, before setting out on his global travels, Merton had moved into full-time residency of a hermitage in the grounds of the Abbey of Our Lady of Gethsemane. He'd always wanted more solitude. Are there any solitaries in the church who just feel uncomfortable that they're not allowed to be solitaries in the church? He had a very gregarious nature, and it was quite a busy hermitage. Many came to visit. Some crazy people were trying to do away with him, some fans, some celebrities, Joan Baez and the like. But he needed his solitude. He couldn't even deal well with the monastic community. He needed aloneness. He didn't seem to flourish with too much company, too much close community. The novices who sat in his classes were sorry to see him go as he told them he was making his way to the hermitage. They jested about a grand procession with acolytes and thurifa and liturgies for the installation of a hermit and all kinds of nonsense. Merton was more concerned about the big king snake that lived in the outhouse, and he had his own little liturgy that I'm not allowed to say because of the language he used. What would he be doing all day? What do hermits do all day? Someone asked Merton to write about how he spent his days.
The hills are blue and hot. There is a brown, dusty field in the bottom of the valley. I hear a machine, a bird, a clock. The clouds are high and enormous. Through them, the inevitable jet plane passes. This time, probably full of passengers from Miami to Chicago. What passengers? This I have no need to decide. They are out of my world up there, busy sitting in their small, isolated, arbitrary lounge that does not even seem to be moving. The lounge that somehow unaccountably picked them up off the earth in Florida to suspend them for a while with timeless cocktails and then let them down in Illinois. The suspension of modern life in contemplation that gets you somewhere. There are also other worlds above me. Other jets will pass over with other contemplations. I have seen the Strategic Air Command plane with the bomb in it fly low over me, and I have looked up out of the woods directly at the closed bay of the metal bird with a scientific egg in its breast, a womb easily and mechanically opened. I do not consider this technological mother to be the friend of anything I believe in. However, like everyone else, I live in the shadow of the apocalyptic cherub. I am surveyed by it impersonally. Its number recognizes my number. Are these numbers preparing at some moment to coincide in the benevolent mind of a computer? This does not concern me, for I live in the woods as a reminder that I am free not to be a number. There is, in fact, a choice. In an age where there is much talk about being yourself, I reserve to myself the right to forget about being myself, since in any case there is very little chance of me being anybody else. Rather, it seems to me that when one is too intent on being himself, he runs the risk of impersonating a shadow. I exist under trees. I walk in the woods out of necessity. I am both a prisoner and an escaped prisoner. I cannot tell you why, born in France, my journey ended here in Kentucky. It makes no difference. I know there are trees here. I know there are birds here. I know the birds, in fact, very well, for there are precise pairs of birds, two each of 15 or 20 species, living in the immediate area of my cabin. I share this particular place with them. We form an ecological balance. This harmony gives the idea of place a new configuration. As to the crows, they form a different pattern. They are vociferous and self-justifying like humans. They are not two, they are many. They fight each other and the other birds in a constant state of war. This is not a hermitage. It is a house. What I wear is pants. What I do is live. How I pray is breathe. Who said Zen? Wash your mouth out if you said Zen. If you see a meditation going by, shoot it. Who said love? Love is in the movies. The spiritual life is something that people worry about when they are so busy with something else that they think they ought to be spiritual. Spiritual life is guilt. Up here in the woods is seen the New Testament. That is to say, the wind comes through the trees and you breathe it.
That very short autobiography was quite different from the best-selling autobiography which 20 years before his death had established Merton as a public figure. The seven-story mountain was the story of a young man who lost his mother at the age of six, his father by 16, whose only brother, Jean-Paul, was lost, missing in action in 1943. That story told of how, after an unsettled life spent mainly in France and England and New York, Merton discovered faith. He discovered faith through Catholic poetry, philosophy, frescoes, and architecture, aided by some classical Christian spiritual practices which a Hindu friend had pointed him towards. Merton felt drawn to the church, a church which his parents had little time for, and he was baptized in 1938. 3 years later, he arrived at the gates of a Trappist monastery during the very week that Japanese bombers attacked Pearl Harbor.
On the last day of January 1915, under the sign of the water bearer, in a year of the Great War, and down in the shadows of some French mountains on the borders of Spain, I came into the world. Free by nature, in the image of God, I was, nevertheless, the prisoner of my own violence and my own selfishness, in the image of the world into which I was born. That world was the picture of hell, full of men like myself, loving God and yet hating him, born to love him, living instead in fear and hopeless self-contradictory hungers. Not many hundreds of miles away from the house where I was born, they were picking up the men who rotted in the rainy ditches among the dead horses and the ruined 75s, in a forest of trees without branches along the River Marne. My father and mother were captives in this world, knowing they did not belong with it or in it, and yet unable to get away from it. They were in the world, but not of it. Not because they were saints, but in a different way. Because they were artists. The integrity of an artist lifts a man above the level of the world without delivering him from it.
Merton would remain a monk of Gethsemane for the remainder of his life. Other than for short visits, for one thing or another, he remained in the monastery, then the hermitage, until he took this long-anticipated journey with permission of a new abbot that made it possible. He travelled as a monk of Gethsemane Abbey to Thailand. Seven Story Mountain has sold millions of copies. It's been translated into many different languages. I think it hasn't been out of print since 1948. And if you've read just a little Merton, it's as likely as anything that it's a Seven Story Mountain that you've read. It's a book he kind of disowned. He grew out of it. If you want to know where to begin with Merton, begin at the end. Work your way back if you're interested in how he became the person he was in those latter years. In a preface written for the 1963 edition, Japanese edition as it happens, Merton made clear that this was a story he had grown out of. But, and he made this clear too, his decision to take his leave from a world of capitalism and propaganda and consumerism and trash media and the delusions of mainstream culture, that decision was never revoked. He never returned to that world, ever. His response to war was non-participation in the roots of war. non-participation, that is, in the American way. His response to poverty was to be voluntarily poor. His response to decadence was ascetic discipline. His response to ecological destruction was to cease all unnecessary consuming. This is from 15 years after the first publication of The Seven Story Mountain.
Perhaps if I were to attempt this book today, it would be written differently. Who knows? But it was written while I was still quite young, and that is the way it remains. The story no longer belongs to me, and I have no right to tell it in a different way, or to imagine that it should have been seen through wiser eyes. In its present form, which will remain its only form, it belongs to many people. The author no longer has an exclusive claim upon his story. Since that time, I have learned, I believe, to look back into that world with greater compassion, seeing those in it not as alien to myself, not as peculiar and deluded strangers, but as identified with myself. In breaking from their world, I have strangely broken from them. In freeing myself from their delusions and preoccupations, I have identified myself nonetheless with their struggles and their blind, desperate hope of happiness. But precisely because I am identified with them, I must refuse all the more definitively to make their delusions my own. I must refuse their ideology of matter, power, quantity, movement, activism, and force. I reject this because I see it as the source and the expression of the spiritual hell which man has made of this world. The hell which has burst into flame in two total wars of incredible horror. The hell of spiritual emptiness and the subhuman fury which has resulted in crimes like Auschwitz and Hiroshima. This I can and must reject with all the power of my being. This all sane men seek to reject. But the question is, how can one sincerely reject the effect if he continues to embrace the cause?
Morecambe and Wise are appearing somewhere. A change of tone is called for. Don't get Mern wrong, he wrote intensely seriously. He lived a rigorous ascetic life and he loved to play.
In this world where we live, there should be more happiness.
Thank you, Phil. Amen. Do I hear an amen? Thank you. He played music. He had a record player in his hermitage. He loved Bob Dylan. He said that Dylan was the new liturgy. He loved the Beatles. He loved Joan Baez, probably more than he ought to have done, actually. And he went to jazz bars when, on rare occasions, his friends took him out from the hermitage to New York City. But that's off the record. Probably the most significant religious writer of 20th century America. We in Europe are gradually catching up with the full impact of his legacy. We're catching up with what he has to teach us. He addresses us with a rare authenticity and a passion so much that preoccupies us now concerned him. We're gradually catching up. We follow the paper trail of his books and essays and letters and journals and poems and recordings more than most of us could ever get through in a single lifetime. About 30 books in his lifetime, more than double that by now. A lot of posthumous books. 20,000 letters have been collected from Merton. acres of poetry, 7 huge volumes of private journals published after the 25-year embargo, 1993 onwards. There's plenty to go on. He saw what was coming with the impact of unharnessed consumerism and the mass communications which feed it and which feed off it. He saw what was coming. He departed this world during a pivotal era, at the cusp of a transition into a media-saturated world that we now inhabit. In some way, he'd taken his leave back in 1941 when he arrived at those monastery gates. And since then, he's given back to us in his absence a literary version of himself in great detail. Himself as companion and teacher and provocation. He became a story to blend with our own. An immensely prolific writer. Take note, he made no money from his writing. If he had, it would not have been the same. Some would call him a success. He hated that. He said some very rude things about people who called him a success or themselves. He just wanted to be real and to inspire others to wake up to reality in all its fullness.
A tree gives glory to God by being a tree. For by being what God means it to be, it is obeying him. The more a tree is like itself, the more it is like him. This particular tree will give glory to God by spreading out its roots in the earth, by raising its branches into the air and the light in a way that no other tree before it or after it ever did or will do. The special clumsy beauty of this particular colt on this April day in this field under these clouds is a holiness consecrated to God by his own creative wisdom and declares the glory of God. The pale flowers of the dogwood outside the window are saints. The little yellow flowers that nobody notices on the edge of the road are saints looking up into the face of God. The leaf has its own texture and its own pattern of veins and its own holy shape. And the bass and the trout hiding in the deep pools of the river are canonized by their beauty and their strength. The lakes hidden among the hills are saints, and the sea too is a saint who praises God without the interruption in her majestic dance. The great gashed mountain, half naked, is another of God's saints. There is no other like him. He is alone in his own character. Nothing else in the world ever did or ever will imitate God in quite the same way. That is his sanctity. For me, to be a saint means to be myself. Therefore, the problem of sanctity and salvation is, in fact, the problem of finding out who I am and of discovering my true self. Trees and animals have no problem. God makes them what they are without consulting them, and they are perfectly satisfied. With us, it is different. God leaves us free to be whatever we like. We can be ourselves or not as we please. We are at liberty to be real or to be unreal. We may be true or false. The choice is ours. We may wear now one mask and now another, and never, if we so desire, appear with our own true face. But we cannot make these choices with impunity. Causes have effect, and if we lie to ourselves and to others, then we cannot expect to find truth and reality wherever we happen to want them. If we have chosen the way of falsity, we must not be surprised that truth eludes us when we finally come to need it.
He became separated in order to live faith with focus and intensity. and to discover and hold on to love, compassion, a sense of radical connectedness with all people. He wandered the wilderness of compassion. From a distance, he discovered with vivid clarity that we are already one. We are already one. How often do you know that? Utterly interdependent, inseparable. You feel it? Occasionally, he'd write about it as though he'd glimpsed that burning bush, or perhaps a bright field. And in this last reading, we're going to take a passage from Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, 1966, and one of the best places to start reading Merton.
In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the centre of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realisation that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another even though we were total strangers. It was like walking from a dream of separateness or spurious self-isolation in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate, holy existence is a dream. Not that I question the reality of my vocation or my monastic life, but the conception of separation from the world that we may have in the monastery too easily presents itself as a complete illusion. The illusion that by making vows we become a different species of being, pseudo-angels, spiritual men, men of interior life, what have you. This sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud. And I suppose my happiness could have taken the form in the words, "Thank God! Thank God I am like other men. That I am only a man among others." To think that for 16 or 17 years I have been taking seriously this pure illusion that is implicit in so much of our monastic thinking. It is a glorious destiny to be a member of the human race. Though it is a race dedicated to many absurdities and one which makes many terrible mistakes, yet with all that, God himself gloried in becoming a member of the human race. A member of the human race. To think that such a commonplace realization should suddenly seem like news that one holds the winning ticket in a cosmic sweepstake. And if only everybody could realize this. But it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. This changes nothing in the sense and value of my solitude, for it is, in fact, the function of solitude to make one realize such things with a clarity that would be impossible to anyone completely immersed in other cares, other illusions, and all the automatisms of a tightly collective existence. My solitude, however, is not my own, for I see how much it belongs to them and that I have a responsibility for it in their regard, not just my own. It is because I am one with them that I owe it to them to be alone, and when I am alone, they are not they, but my own self. There are no strangers. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their hearts where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would all fall down and worship each other. But this cannot be seen, only believed and understood by a peculiar gift.
He was a priest, a monk, a mischievous man of profound integrity and faithfulness. He stayed true to the end. And as we read him, some of us find ourselves developing a strange kind of friendship with this counterpoint. Not that we want to be like him, otherwise we'd just go and be monks, wouldn't we? But he seems to hold us in a tension. And it's a creative tension which constantly pulls us back to the sources of our own faith and makes us ask questions. If we're not living like that, why are we living like this? If we're not living like that, why are we living like this? He keeps on turning us back towards the things that mattered most to him: love, faithfulness, interdependence, integrity, God, ultimately. We're going to take the rest of this time to let you talk and ask questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Any questions, thoughts, comments, reflections? Oh. I think you've left everyone very meditative. Very calm. Here we go.
Thank you for that. I don't know much about Merton, so it's nice to hear a bit more of the story. Just an observation. I take daily meditations from Richard Rohr,
yep.
Franciscan theologian, and he's going through a series of mystics in this last 2 weeks. He's been doing Thomas Merton, so when you read that last one about seeing everybody shining like the sun, I just read that last week, so that was a nice parallelism.
Richard Rohr is one of many who's been inspired by Merton, a good teacher of Merton.
Coming thick and fast now.
Thank you. I've been reading Merton for about 30 years, like you.
Right.
And well that done. The thing about the tree bringing glory to God by being
sure.
a tree, I remember sitting on a train and reading that as I was heading towards York, and I was really obsessed with the question, what am I going to do with my life?
Right.
One of the things Merton makes me think is that is the stupid question. It's not, what am I going to be? And as an evangelical Christian myself, I tend to so often get obsessed with doing things. Mm. And actually, without, and same in Conjectures of Guilty Bystander, his thing is, it's not about what you're doing, it's about what you're being. Because that doing won't make any sense unless the being is right.
Thank you. I like hearing these personal responses, because I think that's part of what Merton does. I too would like to claim that evangelical label. Catholic also, contemplative, activist, I think they all fit at different times. And Merton wouldn't see the boundaries either. I was talking recently with somebody who's now a professor in university in Kentucky, I think it is, who was a young evangelical Baptist, I believe, went to visit Merton as a young student in the late 1960s with a few aggressive evangelicals who were ready to take Merton down. And he tells his story of how Merton just loved these people. And by the end of their time together, they were eating out of his hand. He broke down the labels we put around ourselves to separate ourselves from one another. And he did that continually. It's a great gift. I think he keeps on giving back.
It seems to me that many of the things that Merton wrote about were from nature and inspired by beauty.
Yeah.
And I remember being challenged by my spiritual director in the 80s, living in East London, which is, I mean, the people were great, but the environment was quite challenging, to see God in ugliness. And I wonder if Merton wrote about being able to see beyond just nature, which, you know, inspires a lot of us to see God in nature.
It's a great question, and it's a problematic one. I direct you to a lovely little book called At Home in the World, which is letters between Thomas Merton and Rosemary Radford Ruther, who, as a young theologian, had a go at Merton. They began dialogue over the church. She was writing on the church. And it's a friendly approach, but she's quite aggressive about monasticism, which she sees as a spent force and a pointless venture. And a lot of it is about where we're located. It's a complex conversation to sum up in a short way. Merton made a key decision as a young man to go to the monastery or to work in Harlem, where he'd been volunteering in some of the poorest tenements in that neighborhood. And he was very clear that Harlem was a good place to be a Christian, but it wasn't his place to be a Christian. And if you're looking for good writing on the city, I don't think Merton does it. He loved New York. He absolutely loved New York. And some of his meditations on the life of that city and its jazz and everything are precious. But when it comes to our own cities, I wrote a piece a while ago because I've been in a riot twice in Hyde Park in Leeds where I was minister. And I wrote a piece on Merton's thoughts on the city in light of that, challenging him because he could only know so much by not living in that kind of environment. But sometimes he pulls us back from the immediacy of the city to say, what is beautiful about this?
I'm not sure whether I've picked up a paradox or a contradiction, but at some point he says that if you become obsessed with being yourself, you risk being a shadow.
Yeah.
And then we're being encouraged to be ourselves and to be rather than to do. What do we do about the risks in our search to be?
Okay. I suppose partly in response to the previous question, just live your life, stop thinking about it. would be his first response. Our being doing duality is a bit of nonsense because you're always being something, you're always doing something. You don't have a choice. It's not one or the other. It's just silly. But let's think about being attentive, something Paula was saying over there and not long ago. Whatever it is you're doing something now. Just be really in it, really in it. Whatever life calls you to, you're more likely to be responsive to it. The final thing in response to your question is don't expect Merton not to be contradictory. He is endlessly contradicting himself. And you need to really read into him quite deeply to recognize that that's part of his nature and he doesn't care.
Any other questions? There's one there. Is that great? Time for one last one.
You mentioned his epiphany with the giant Buddha. Mm. Can you say a bit more about his relationship with Buddhism? Because I know he had some key contacts, didn't he, with Buddhist thinkers?
Yeah, and there's a whole series of lectures on that. His interfaith relations at that time, especially during the 1960s, probably fair to say that troubled the Vatican and the public more than anything. It's almost second nature to many of us now. At that time, it wasn't. We need to remember that. He was never other than an Orthodox Christian. Say that again, because it's really important. He was never other than an Orthodox Christian who read his Bible, knew it very well, meditated it daily, went through his prayers on a daily basis. Other faiths and probably Zen Buddhism more than others. though he had relations with people of many faiths, probably Zen Buddhism more than any other, expanded his Christianity. It gave him a new language, a bigger language for being Christian. It gave him practices which were not that hot on in the church often. How to be still, how to meditate, how to be attentive. And he drew on those in order to deepen and enrich his own Christianity. I've been very general and vague in that response. We could say a lot more. There's a lovely book on Merton and Buddhism, quite a big one, which just charts his relationship with people of Zen in particular over the years.
Is there anybody I didn't spot who had hands up for questions or comments? Wave, exaggeratedly. Brilliant. I haven't missed anyone. It's been 2 days, that's how long we've been here. But there's been a lot of talk about idleness and being rather than doing in this venue. So if you are interested in exploring that beyond Merton's thoughts, look up some of the talks we had, How to Be Idle, and something with a title like How Not to Be Crucified, or How Not to Crucify Yourself in Doing This. So I think something's coming together in this festival here this weekend. Thank you very, very much, Gary, for an amazing talk and illuminating on Thomas Merton. So thank you for being here with us.